Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point.
My name is Kalita Butler. My business is Top Secret Bundles, and I sell lip gloss, lashes, and hair extensions. But my bestseller is lip gloss.
Kalita runs her business on TikTok. She's 23 and lives in Fairborn, Ohio. And she's one of the 100 million Americans and more than 800 million people worldwide who use the social media app to get news, to sell goods, and, yeah, to dance a lot. Now, TikTok is also at the center of tension between the United States and China, a dispute between two global powers over national security and data privacy. Now, Kalita did not know what TikTok would do for her or her business when she created an account in May. But by the time President Trump threatened to ban the app in the U.S. this month, Kalita says she couldn't imagine life without it.
I was actually kind of hesitant to start on TikTok. As everybody knows, TikTok was kind of like the dance app. It was like, there's no point in me going to TikTok because I don't dance. So I was like, well, I don't want to sit and watch people dance all day. But then I end up seeing a video on Instagram of somebody going viral, like posting their business stuff on TikTok. So I was like, well, I'll just give it a try. I was kind of expecting to like go viral off of one video, but it obviously didn't go like that. And then I posted a couple of dance videos. Still nothing. So I'm like, well, I don't really know how this app really works because TikTok is kind of tricky. It's like you can post what's popular, but if you're not really getting pushed to the For You page, it's like, you know, it doesn't really work out. It was like 10 o'clock at night. I saw a business video and I'm like, I'm going to try this one more time. And if this doesn't work, then I'm just going to leave TikTok alone. It blew up.
Thank you in advance. I don't want to dance.
Nope. I was literally just filling a lip gloss tube with my lip gloss machine, which I used to fill my lip gloss, and everybody loved it. I don't know if they liked the lip gloss machine or they liked the fact that my lip gloss tubes have LED light on them. Like, I'm not really sure what they liked, but that video kind of like changed my life, if you could say.
The day in my life as an entrepreneur. First, I make my bid. Then I check on my son. Yes, I have a son. Yes, I am married. Not that it really matters. Then I make hot chocolate.
When I first heard about President Trump potentially banning TikTok in the U.S., literally every creator that I followed was like going live. The caption in their live was like, is TikTok getting banned? Question mark. Some people say like, TikTok is my life. I spend my whole day on TikTok. How do I cope with life? I was nervous and scared because, well, most of my sales, most of my business promotion and support comes from TikTok.
So I was thinking about doing a webinar. If you'll be interested in that, just comment in the comment section. There will be limits.
I was trying to figure out ways to like trick the system. Like if you ban it in the U.S., okay, I'll just change my region to Canada, or I'll just change it to somewhere else so I can still promote and stuff on TikTok. I mean, I would be really sad if it went away. I honestly don't know if my business will do as well if TikTok went away, if most of my followers didn't come to my other social media platforms.
So this video was highly requested, how to find the vendors that I offer on my website. So you just want to go to my website, click shop, and then click start your business.
It's a lot of opportunities on TikTok, a lot of friendships to be built, a lot of businessships to be built. So I've even seen videos of people meet the love of their life on TikTok. It's a lot of diversity on TikTok. And I think that's what we need right now. People have told me that I've inspired them to start a business and they started businesses. It's a lot that you can learn and take away.
Kalita Butler is a TikTok user and a small business owner in Fairborn, Ohio. And she was talking about the friendships to be made on TikTok, about the business opportunities, about the learning. So how did all that get mixed up in tensions between Washington and Beijing? Well, joining us now from Denver, Colorado, is Louise Matsakis, staff writer at Wired, covering TikTok, Amazon, and other online platforms. Louise, welcome to the program.
Hi, Magna. Thanks for having me.
So there's nothing that makes me feel older than talking about an app that my 9-year-old neighbor schools me on every single day. So first of all, for people who don't have TikTok on their phones, can you just explain, what is it?
You're definitely not alone. It makes a lot of people feel old. So it's a video app that's really driven by this algorithm called the For You algorithm. So when you open up the app, the algorithm feeds you a series of videos. So you can swipe through them. They're short, vertical clips. And over time, the algorithm learns what you like. For example, my For You page is full of people thrift shopping. I get a lot of cooking videos, whereas my partner's is a lot of video game clips, funny stunts and pranks. So over time, the algorithm learns what you like, and it shows you more of that content and less of everything else. So it's a really kind of artificial intelligence driven platform, which is really different from something like Facebook or Instagram, where you primarily follow people you know, influencers, maybe celebrities, but you choose how to curate feed, whereas TikTok curates the feed for you.
Okay, so big difference there then. And it's constantly learning what you like. And the content that it serves up, these are like short clips we're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. They range from anywhere between like, you know, a couple seconds to about a minute or so. But they're really short, you know, much shorter than something like YouTube, which I think is really appealing to a lot of people because you can watch a lot of different stuff at once. Whereas watching YouTube, I think these days is more akin to like Netflix, right? It's like the videos tend to be like 15, 30 minutes, whereas on TikTok, you know, it's 1 minute. I think I have a little peanut brain at this point from TikTok because the videos are so short that it's really easy to keep my attention. Whereas on YouTube, I'm like, this is just too long.
I'm going to say that based on your reporting, you do not yet have a peanut brain, Louise. We need your big brain about digital platforms to help us through this. Okay, so that's what TikTok is. 100 million users in the United States. It's almost 1 in 3 people in this country. So it is a massive presence here. Who, at this point in time, who owns it?
So TikTok is the creation of a Chinese tech company called ByteDance. So in China, ByteDance was already known for creating very similar viral apps, including a sister app to TikTok that works very similarly. They also have a news app. They had a joke app for a while. So I think it's fair to say that ByteDance is kind of like a Facebook, a Silicon Valley company in China. But a couple years ago, they came to the US and created this app called TikTok. So they still fully own the company as of now.
Okay, so this is where things start getting complicated, right? And where this big geopolitical fight comes in. So you said they came to the US, but they're a Chinese company. So where is ByteDance actually located? And does that location actually matter?
So they have offices in Beijing. They have offices in other parts of China. However, TikTok has a U.S. headquarters in Los Angeles, and they also have offices across the U.S. So TikTok, ByteDance will say, is an American company that's run by an American CEO. However, the parent company is ByteDance. And the U.S. government will say that that absolutely matters, and it's a national security risk for a major social media platform to be owned by a Chinese company, is what the U.S. government will say.
Owned by a Chinese company. What relationship does ByteDance have with the Chinese government?
So that's an interesting question. I think by default, all companies in China have a closer relationship with the government than a company in the U.S. might have with the government. You know, they do not have the authority to say no if the Chinese government came and said, hey, we would like some of your data, or we would like you to take, you know, steps X, Y, or Z. Whereas I think, you know, Facebook or Google probably wants to comply with the U.S. administration, but they have a lot more authority to push back. However, I think it's important for people to realize that ByteDance is not exactly a stooge of the Communist Party. You know, I think that this is a company that, like I said, was really modeled after Silicon Valley giants. I think that they want to be a very global, modern technology company. I don't think that they sought out to start a company that was going to be best friends with the CCP or best friends with Xi Jinping. This is a company that, you know, runs on capitalism. It's an advertising company. They want as many users as possible and to make as much money as possible. I think that that's what they're driven by, rather than, you know, wanting to help the party or wanting to be a spy app or something like that. I don't think that that's their intention.
Okay. And yet, but whatever TikTok or ByteDance's intentions are, there are these deeper concerns about data privacy and the flow of information from 100 million American smartphones to a Chinese company. So we're going to talk more about those concerns in a second here. But what is the status of this deal? First of all, what is the deal that's being tussled over right now between ByteDance and potential American partners?
So let's back up first to early August, when President Trump signed an executive order that basically forced ByteDance to find an American buyer or else risk being blocked in the United States. And this was a very unprecedented move. You know, the U.S. government has never blocked an app in this way before. So TikTok began scrambling, seeing, you know, figuring out who would buy the app. At first, they thought it was going to be Microsoft, and then they ended up rejecting a deal from Microsoft. And now they've struck an agreement with Oracle. So the idea is that Oracle, along with Walmart, would take a stake in TikTok, and Oracle would become TikTok's trusted technology partner, and they would have some ability to audit TikTok's code, maybe to look at the algorithm to ensure that there was no national security risk. So that's the deal that TikTok, Oracle, and Walmart have put before the U.S. government. However, you know, initially Trump said, okay, this sounds great. It's a great deal for America. But then, you know, some news reports came out that ByteDance actually didn't want to give up the majority of control of TikTok to American investors. It, you know, seemed more like Oracle and Walmart would be minority investors and ByteDance would remain in control. So once Trump got word of that, he said, you know, I'm not sure if we're going to accept this. So the deal is still in question. TikTok is now trying to go to a judge, actually, to get an injunction on the ban, because I think that they're starting to realize that maybe this deal is not going to go through. Anyway, the app has until September 27th, which is the new deadline set by the U.S. Department of Commerce, before the app will be blocked.
So 3 days. 3 days for them to figure out an acquisition deal that would put American companies in the majority stakeholder position and needs to be approved by the Commerce Department. Is that what I hear?
Yes, that is correct. And whether that or not that happens is definitely still up in the air.
Okay. So Louise Matsakis with Wired, stand by here for just a second. We are wading our way through the story of TikTok and why it finds itself, this app finds itself at the center of tensions between Washington and Beijing. We have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast. Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we are talking about TikTok and why the wildly popular social media app is at the center of basically a geopolitical dispute about national security and data privacy. And I'm joined today by Louise Matsakis. She's staff writer at Wired, covering TikTok, Amazon, and other online platforms. She's been reporting about TikTok extensively, and we have links to that reporting at onpointradio.org. Now let's listen a little bit to some of the most popular TikTokers in the world. For example, Charlie D'Amelio has over 88 million followers on TikTok, making her the most popular user on the app. There's now a drink named after Charlie on the Dunkin' menu, and here she is announcing that new drink in a TikTok video. And this one video itself received over 10 million likes.
I'm at Dunkin' right now, about to order the Charlie for the first time ever.
Hi, welcome
Welcome to Dunkin'.
Hi, may I please order the Charlie?
Yeah, we've got that right here for you. We'll see you out the window.
Thank you. You guys are going to want to try this. Mask time.
There you go.
Oh my goodness, thank you so much.
You're welcome, enjoy.
Thank you. Teehee.
Mega TikToker Charlie D'Amelio there. Now, Lauren Gray was the most followed creator on TikTok for a while until Charlie surpassed her. Lauren has now 47 million followers and posted this video of herself singing back in May, and this one video has 800 or more than 800,000 likes. A little taste there of a TikTok video from creator Lauren Gray. Well, joining us now from New York is Sam Sachs. Sam is Cybersecurity Policy Fellow at New America and a Senior Fellow at Yale Law School's Paul Tsai China Center. Sam, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
So, first of all, can you just tell us what is fundamentally at stake here? What are the concerns that the United States has about TikTok and its Chinese ownership?
So let's break it down. I think there are two main issues here. One is data security, and the second is a kind of extraterritorial censorship from the Chinese government. Let's look at each, right? So with data security, I think in the clips that we've heard so far on the program, to the listeners, it's not clear why is this a national security issue. And I think the risk is less that, you know, the information about Dunkin' Donuts or about lip gloss is going to give the Chinese government individually some kind of strategic intelligence advantage, right? That's not sensitive data. The argument that I think the national security community is arguing, which I actually disagree with, and I'll tell you guys why, is that in aggregate, that information can pose a risk because of two main reasons. One is there's the hypothetical argument that the Chinese government is creating these dossiers on Americans, not just taking individual data, but pooling millions of data sets from TikTok with, say, data that we think or we assume the Chinese government has acquired from, say, the hack of Office of Personnel Management, which had very sensitive national security clearance information, or the Equifax hack. Mm-hmm. And maybe if you combine that data set, it could be used, say, for a blackmail operation against an individual, or, and this is one that I think is particularly far-fetched, targeting an autonomous weapons system. The second risk, and we could talk about the legitimacy of those claims in a moment. The second risk is about censorship, the idea that we know the Chinese government has the most sophisticated censorship system in the world, using the golden shield, or what's known outside of China as the Great Firewall. And there have been some pretty murky examples where it's, you know, has TikTok taken down content on the platform related to, say, Xinjiang or Hong Kong? And could the algorithm, that secret sauce, which makes it so addictive, be used to boost or remove content that would be seen by viewers outside of China's closed system?
Okay, so two very weighty concerns there. Let's take the first one here. And Louise, let me turn back to you here for a second. So about these potential national security concerns. I mean, this isn't the first time that the U.S. government has cited national security as a reason to pay very close attention to Chinese-originated technology and apps. I mean, I'm thinking of Huawei in terms of actual hardware, but also Grindr, right? Wasn't there an attempt to acquire Grindr by a Chinese company at one time?
Yeah, exactly. So a Chinese company tried to acquire Grindr, and this committee called the Committee on Foreign Investment in the U.S., which is the same government agency that's interested in TikTok, blocked that acquisition, actually, and said, hey, for national security concerns, we don't want security reasons. We don't want a Chinese company to own. And I think that was very obvious, right? There's the
Louise, I'm going to just jump in here because your line is getting the quality of the line is degrading quite rapidly. So we're going to reboot that line and get you back because what you're saying is too important. So hang on here. So Sam, let me just turn back to you then. And I don't know if you wanted to pick up where Louise was leaving off about previous.
I can talk about the Grindr case. Yeah, go ahead. So the concern with Grindr is Grindr was acquired by a Chinese gaming company called Beijing Kunlun Tech. And the idea is, okay, we know that Grindr has potentially sensitive information about people's sexual relationships, their dating history. What if, going back to that triangulation question, mm-hmm. what if the data collected from Grindr, presumably in the hands of a Chinese entity, is corroborated with that Office of Personnel Management national security files and could, hypothetically, because there's no specific evidence, but it's a hypothetical, could that information be used, say, to blackmail someone who is in the process of applying for a national security clearance that would make them beholden to the Chinese government? Now, the difference with Grindr and TikTok, I think that that is plausible. I don't think that's a very effective way. If I were a Chinese government intelligence operative, that to me would be a very inefficient way to go about targeting and blackmailing somebody, but it's conceivable. With the TikTok case, I think that there's less of a specific smoking gun there. It's harder to understand how exactly, beyond a sort of murky hypothetical, that could create some kind of strategic advantage.
Okay, so let me ask you though. I'm thinking of Shoshana Zuboff's work on her like monumental book, Surveillance Capitalism, and how she talks about
amazing work.
All the data that some of these apps do harvest off people's phones just by virtue of downloading it, you've unknowingly approved of this happening. Let me put it this way: do we know if TikTok itself is a Trojan horse? Does it pull data off people's phones that they may not know about, and could that be a potential national security risk?
So Surveillance Capitalism, phenomenal book, right? I think what this does is it gets at the heart of an issue, which is the monetization, the use of people's data to manipulate and shape behavior. And here the threat, I think, with TikTok, we're blurring two distinct issues.
Okay.
One is privacy and the use of data for monetization and manipulation. But the other is national security and the geopolitics around the U.S.-China competition. So I think that the threat with the algorithm is it bombards viewers with content to keep them hooked on the app the same way Shoshana Zuboff describes, so that the app can collect more data and use that data to learn more about what will hook people to spend more time on the app and then monetize that, sell that to a digital advertiser who can go, okay, here is, and in my case, you're a working mom who stays home a lot of the day, and then you leave at 5 o'clock to pick up your kid. You know, let's push this working mom products in her data segment. You know, that's a privacy concern that I would say is not unique to TikTok, but is something that we are grappling with across apps and services at a moment where it's a wild west in the United States. There is no federal privacy law that controls that.
Mm. Louise, do we have you back?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, great. So you heard what Sam was just talking about the some blurring of lines here, and I was wondering what your response is to that.
I totally agree. I think what's confusing here is that we have no national privacy law. We have all these other apps like Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, you know, Google apps, that for, you know, years now, Congress, other federal agencies have been talking about as a privacy risk, right? And all of a sudden, TikTok comes along and the government acts. But why has the government not acted more generally to pass legislation to enact principles to protect privacy all around? Instead, we're kind of getting these privacy concerns completely mixed together with the national security concerns. And I think that that's a result of the fact that the administration has still not really been very specific about what TikTok is doing that's unique. The only thing that they've said again and again is that it's owned by a Chinese company. So that leaves a lot of room for interpretation of like, what is the app specifically doing, which is a great question. And the answer is nothing that's unique. So why are we not doing anything to, you know, curb the behavior of all of these apps?
Uh-huh. Nothing that's unique, but it might just be doing it better for now than some of the other apps. But Sam, so let me turn back to you here. I just want to give you a chance to really convince me about why you don't share these same national security concerns that the Trump administration has. I mean, you've been talking about that, but bottom line, why do you think that people at this point in time in terms of American U.S. security shouldn't be so worried?
So I think I disagree a bit with Louise on the point that what TikTok is doing is not unique, in the sense that we do know that there have been some murkiness around content that's definitely censored in China. And so that is different, right? But does that pose a U.S. national security risk? So say there was a user on TikTok that made a video where she was curling her eyelashes. And then in the process of curling her eyelashes, she ended up talking about Uyghurs being detained in Xinjiang. Mm-hmm. And then her account was sort of in a bit of a sort of, it was deactivated, but then it was reactivated. And apparently it was a technical glitch. And who knows what really happened? So that is I think there are some areas that are China specific and some areas that aren't. If that was deactivated because she was curling her eyelashes and talking about Xinjiang, that is a very specific China related instance. So could that algorithm, which is what makes it so addictive, could that algorithm be used to push Chinese Communist Party propaganda to, American teenagers, right, in ways that could be destabilizing to the U.S. government? I think if we're at the point where we're worried about Chinese propaganda destabilizing our government because it's getting into the hands of these viral videos, we have much bigger problems on our hands. I think that what would happen is most users would probably just abandon the app if they were fed that kind of content. I mean, to be frank, Chinese propaganda is pretty blatant. And so now the question, though, is are they going to take down, content that, should be seen. And here, I think now that TikTok is really under the microscope, they would be very hard pressed to remove that kind of content again, particularly if they're segmenting and going to the lengths that they have.
Okay. What you said, Sam, right there was so, so interesting. There's a lot I want to peel back here. And first of all, I hope I'm not getting my sort of legal frameworks confused here, but don't U.S. social media companies who operate in, say, China or any other country around the world, they must follow the laws of that country, and they willingly make changes to their algorithms in order to be in those markets. I'm just thinking about all the compromises that Facebook has made to be in China. I mean, that so to ask, first of all, is that true? And the second of all, to ask ByteDance and TikTok to do the same in order to be, not a national security threat in the United States, isn't that reasonable?
What you're getting at here is the idea of reciprocity. And this has become a really key issue with the Trump administration. Should the U.S. government response be to reciprocate the treatment that U.S. firms and particularly social media firms have faced in China for years? Facebook is not in China as far as offering a social media platform. It is in China in that it gets ad revenue from China, but Facebook can't offer its services in China. Mm-hmm. Google doesn't have a search engine, although again, there's ad revenue there. And Twitter is blocked. And so the idea is, a decade after these U.S. social media companies have been shut out of China, the U.S. government is coming back around and reciprocating. So some would say, look, China started it. My response to that is twofold. The first is, okay, if we're talking about reciprocity, to what end? What are we trying to achieve by that goal? And is that effective at achieving that? And if the goal is data security, well, has banning TikTok helped improve data security? And we can talk about why I think it has not. But the second is, the Chinese government does a lot of stuff that I don't think the U.S. government would like to do. So going down that path is not necessarily a smart move, in particular because I think one of the things that could happen from this is, remember, this is not just happening between the U.S. and China. Europe, India, other governments around the world are just as concerned about the surveillance powers of U.S. tech firms in their markets. And they're going to go, This is a blueprint. If we want to block Google, if we want to block Amazon and Facebook, that we are already really concerned about their harvesting of our citizens' data, now we have an example of using these national security justifications to do so.
Yeah. Okay. So, Louise, did you have a thought about that?
Yeah, I think that Sam makes a great point. And I think it's important to think about, yeah, what are the limits of this reciprocity and what could happen there? And I also think it takes us down this very unprincipled path, because if we're just going tit for tat with China, China's always going to go lower than us. And is that really going to result in a better outcome for Americans? I think it's also important to consider that we value the First Amendment. We value free speech, which China doesn't. So what are the consequences of blocking a platform that 100 million Americans use for free speech, especially just weeks before an incredibly consequential election? So I think that's a lot of those are a lot of concerns there that are not really being addressed by just, okay, we want to kind of show China that we mean business, or, you know, show China that we're willing to go as low as they are. All those other things kind of get swept under the rug as a result.
Hmm. Well, we have to dive into a break here. And when we come back, I want to talk with both of you more about the issue of censorship in various forms here. And then also more deeply, what I'm hearing is a lack of a 21st century global regulatory framework around information. And what do we do about that? So we are talking about TikTok and how it finds this app is at the center of these big questions about data privacy, about national security between Washington and Beijing. We'll have more when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour about TikTok and about how this app, 800 million users worldwide, 100 million right here in the United States, is at the center of very big questions about data security, about national security, and ongoing tensions between the United States and China. I'm joined today by Louise Matsakis. Louise is a staff writer at Wired covering TikTok, Amazon, and other online platforms. And we have links to her reporting at onpointradio.org. Sam Sachs also joins us. Sam is a cybersecurity policy fellow at New America and a senior fellow at Yale Law School's Paul Tsai China Center. Now, let's listen for a moment to a TikToker. This is Kareem Rama, who has 400,000 followers on the app. He posts TikToks about comedy and politics. And here's one of his recent posts where he imitates an ASMR post using whispers to create sounds that cause a tingling sensation on the back of the neck.
I know that things seem very hopeless right now, but they're not. There are only some things you can control. One of those things is voting. You can vote. It's your right as an American.
Now, Kareem talked to us this week about the fact that he has seen a major shift in political messages on TikTok after Black Lives Matter protests sprung up across the country earlier this year.
I think that TikTok is to Black Lives Matter and current societal issues as to what Twitter was during the Arab Spring. And I think that's kind of like what the kids and the youth are using it for. I've seen a humongous influx of kind of political and social commentary on the app since this summer. But I think for the youth, TikTok is the de facto news source and news platform.
That's Kareem Rama, a TikToker who has more than 400,000 followers on the app. Now, Louise, can you just talk a little bit more? Because Sam mentioned this earlier about TikTok being, as Kareem was saying there, an actual news source for a whole generation of people. How powerful of a source is it?
It's definitely a really powerful source. I think that what's so powerful about it is that because of the algorithm, it puts news in people's feeds when they're not necessarily looking for it. So it's a way that you can raise awareness about issues that people might not be seeking out specifically. So, you know, you're watching a makeup video or something, and all of a sudden the next video is about Black Lives Matter, or it's about Joe Biden, or it's about President Trump. And I think that it's a way to disseminate these messages to people who might not be necessarily looking for them. It's also a platform that's extremely popular among young people, especially in the United States. About half of those 100 million users actually use the app every single day. And they might not be listening to something like NPR or reading the New York Times, but this is how they're getting their information.
Give them a couple of years, I hope. And they will be listening to NPR, fingers crossed. But getting serious again, Sam, so we keep talking about this algorithmically driven content that's being pushed to all these phones. I mean, tell me more about why, again, you just don't agree with the U.S.'s concerns that some, you know, people are writing those algorithms. They can be tweaked. And so why do you feel more confident than the U.S. government does in terms of the information flow through TikTok not being at risk of meddling from China?
I guess I should reframe to say I do share the concerns, but I think that this problem is not we're conflating a U.S.-China conflict mm-hmm. with a much bigger issue, which is how do you manage online speech in an environment around the world where this is how people are getting information that will determine their response to global pandemics and in a massively important election? And so this is an opportunity, I think, for the U.S. government to take stock of a much bigger set of issues, which is right now we're in a world where you have the China model for controlling digital content, and then you have the Silicon Valley hands-off model where it's a Wild West again. Mm-hmm. And so I think by focusing and obsessing over the TikTok algorithm, we're actually losing sight of a much bigger challenge that needs to be solved in a more comprehensive way, which is not focused on the country of origin, but is looking across the board at all platforms.
So this is an extraordinarily important point. It seems to me what both of you are describing is the government's of the United States and China approaching what is effectively a 21st century challenge through the tools and lenses of 20th century geopolitics, right? So where would we begin to craft a more global regulatory framework around the algorithms, the development of these apps, the flow of information? Where would we even begin, Sam?
So I think first we need to spend less time picking out various Chinese companies that are threats and playing a game of whack-a-mole. Mm-hmm. And we need to spend more time developing the legislation and the standards to really get at these bigger issues. And there are a number of bills that are sort of trickling through U.S. Congress on this, you know, things like algorithmic transparency, things like looking at more robust rules for how data is collected, how it's used, who it's shared with, how it's transmitted, plain old cybersecurity. You know, when we look at things like the Equifax hack by very sophisticated Chinese state-sponsored hackers, Equifax's poor security practices were well documented, right? And so I think the idea is all of these issues and the vulnerabilities they create, both from a speech standpoint, a privacy standpoint, a cybersecurity standpoint, these are things that we need to work on developing rules around. And I think it's also an opportunity, honestly, for the U.S. government to step up and assert leadership in this space. I think we are trying to fight a great power competition through China when what we really need to do is figure out what's our vision for how to govern the internet.
Okay, so frank question, Sam, because I know you've testified before Congress. Do you think that U.S. lawmakers even have an understanding of what the new rules of the game ought to be by virtue of, you know, of their age, of their fluency with digital technologies. Because I'm thinking back to when Mark Zuckerberg testified before Congress, and I think it was Senator Lindsey Graham who was like, how do you make your money? And Mark Zuckerberg had to just say, we sell ads. Like, they didn't even know that much. So if we're trying to come up with new, you're asking the U.S. government to step up and be a leader here in developing these new regulations. Is there the capacity in Washington?
It's a good question. I think it's a mixed bag. There are certainly some representatives who do, and I've been in active conversations with staff members on that. In March, I testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee, and Senator Hawley has sort of taken TikTok on as a crusade. And I think he sees, you know, the alignment of big tech in the U.S. and Beijing as a really important domestic political platform, right? So it's a mixed bag, and it's important, I think, for lawmakers to understand truly what's at stake here is much bigger than a U.S.-China rivalry.
Mm. Louise, did you have a thought about that, about the very lawmakers who were asking to sort of step up and think in a more 21st century format here?
Yeah, I mean, I think you can look to places like California, for example, that is trying to enact a privacy law right now that's very strong and very sophisticated, or to Europe that's already passed GDPR. I think it's also important for lawmakers to not only consider the actual like privacy legislation, but to also think about what's a comprehensive approach to combating China's technological rise. That includes things like perhaps handling a pandemic effectively so we can get Americans back to work. That includes investment in industries like the semiconductor industry, investments in Silicon Valley to ensure that we continue to be a leader when it comes to technology. You know, just going after individual apps and this whack-a-mole approach, as Sam described, is not going to solve this problem in the long term. It's a very short-term approach, and I think that we need something that's very comprehensive, both regulatory and investment. You know, I think that those are going to be two aspects that need to go hand-in-hand if we really want to combat these issues.
Mm. Now, here's a question for both of you. I in a way, you got to sympathize with the federal government here, because I don't know how it would be possible to see this outside of the lens of China's rise, China's global rise and its increasing power economically, politically, militarily. I mean, the information space is an area of profound national security concern. So, given that, Sam, again, like, is it worth trying to come up with solutions that are outside of that geopolitical lens? But at the same time, those national security concerns will be there, and they're growing.
You touch on a great point, because I think we actually can't look at these domestic regulatory issues in isolation from the broader international landscape. The challenge is to do it in a smart way. So the Mark Zuckerberg approach of don't regulate Facebook because then we won't be able to compete with China, that's flawed. But I think he's right about something, which is there is a competition. And how do we make sure that the decisions we're making in a domestic context are not in a silo, so we don't understand what the geopolitical consequences of those will be? I think that the first thing we have to do is recognize that we're going to have to coexist with a globally strong China and Chinese tech companies. So the Secretary of State Pompeo has announced a clean network initiative, which would essentially purge Chinese telecom equipment from internet infrastructure that Americans would have to rely on around the world. The problem with this is he's deluded, because we live in an interconnected world. And so the trick is, how do you have security in a low trust, interconnected world where there are going to be actors in the system that we are going to connect with and that are going to create vulnerabilities? And I would address it like that. Let's take coexistence with a globally powerful China as a given and work back from how do you create security in that?
Mm. Now, Sam, when you were talking about internet equipment, was that specifically Huawei?
So it's Huawei, but it's bigger. So I think this Clean Network Initiative, it covers apps, it covers cloud. It's really designed to focus on American diplomatic infrastructure. So the idea that when an embassy around the world communicates back with headquarters in DC, there would be no Chinese equipment in that, presumably Huawei. But the language is much broader and could provide the basis, depending on how it's implemented in follow-on regulation, you know, to go after companies like an Alibaba or the Chinese drone maker DJI is another one. There are a number of them that are in the crosshairs right now with this positioning of the U.S. government.
Okay. So, Louise, are there other apps in addition to what Sam apps or companies that Sam pointed out that could end up being making more news in ways that they don't want to? I mean, would it?
Definitely. So there's a plethora of apps that U.S. users use every single day, like different games, different sorts of apps that are owned by Chinese companies or partially owned by Chinese companies. I think the biggest one here is WeChat, which was also the subject of an executive order signed by the president in August. And that app is also in a political limbo right now where, you know, it also might get banned soon. That's a messaging app owned by the Chinese tech giant Tencent. Tencent also has a number of stakes in U.S. gaming companies and a lot of entertainment platforms here in the U.S. So I think that Sam is absolutely correct, which is we already live in an interconnected world. Even if you decided to try and, you know, scrub the U.S. of every single Chinese tech company every single day on Facebook, on Instagram, there's going to be Chinese ad networks. There's going to be Chinese telecom equipment that those data flow through, right? So I think that it's impossible to, you know, envision this world where the internet never connects through China or a Chinese company.
So we've got a couple of minutes left here, about 3 minutes left. And I want to hear from both of you, just focusing back down on TikTok just for a moment here, because, I mean, obviously this is still unresolved. As Louise was telling us earlier, I mean, TikTok's seeking an injunction, a court injunction to stop the banning of the app, which could happen in 72 hours or so. So Sam, what do you think would be the best resolution for the current TikTok impasse?
Well, I think we've already gone far down the path of a resolution that I think is not ideal. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to pretend that we could maybe rewind the clock back to, say, August. And this was the solution that I think. I think we should put TikTok under the microscope, you know, and figure and really audit third party. Who's holding the data? How is it being transmitted? Is it being shared with ByteDance, for example, in China? And I think we need to also recognize that not all data is the same level of sensitivity. Start developing frameworks for identifying where do we want to treat certain data as national security data? How do we want to parse what's from a privacy perspective important? And I think we need to get down this path of creating comprehensive federal privacy. So this is not a near-term solution to TikTok. It's sort of using TikTok as an impetus to address these larger issues.
Yeah. Now, Louise, I'm seeing here that you tell me if I'm right or wrong, that it's possible that if there's a majority ownership stake in TikTok, if that's where we end up, that ByteDance might not even hand over the all the information about the algorithm. It's a little confusing to me.
Yeah. So basically, I think that ByteDance and TikTok, as well as Oracle and Microsoft and kind of all the players here, are trying to talk out of both sides of their mouth. They're trying to please Trump, saying that, you know, it's going to be majority owned by U.S. investors, it's going to be totally safe. And then I think ByteDance is trying to say to Beijing, we're not exporting the technology. You know, there's no reason to be butthurt here. It's going to be fine. And the problem is that those messages don't align, right? There's some sort of discrepancy between them. And that's really confusing right now. I think that basically TikTok has become this political hot potato, which is really unfortunate, both for the users of the app, for the company itself. And I think that the problem is that it makes all of these other issues disappear about federal privacy legislation, about how do we handle national security in the 21st century. I think the best outcome is that, maybe Oracle takes a stake and the company can continue to exist in the country, especially as this election is approaching. I think it's really important to not cut off avenues of free speech, but it's really unclear. I wish we could rewind the clock, like Sam said, and do this in a more principled way.
Well, all we can do right now is continue to move forward and see what happens. So Louise Matsakis, staff writer at Wired. Louise, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Sam Sachs, Cybersecurity Policy Fellow at New America and Senior Fellow at Yale Law School's PolSci China Center. Sam, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
We'll keep our eye on this and hopefully have them both back when the TikTok issue gets sorted out. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.